To study of Genesis, and today we're looking at chapters 14 and 15 mainly. So chapters 14 and 15, we're going to start at the end of 13, but turn there and we'll proceed studying about Abram. So very good to be together. Earl, could you lead us in a prayer as we start our class?
Our Father and our God, we thank you for this opportunity to be here today. Pray that you'll be with us as we open the book of Genesis and study from it, and pray that the things that we learn would help us to understand you better, understand the history of these early patriarchs and their families, and how it relates to us, and help us to learn from the things that they did, right and wrong, and how it affected their relationship with you. Help us to learn these lessons so that we can make the proper application to our own lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
All right, so what's happened with Abram and his nephew Lot, who now is part of Abraham's family as they've migrated from Ur to Haran at the apex of the Fertile Crescent down to the land of Canaan, living as nomads there with their flocks and herds? What's happened between Abraham and Lot?
Well, he had to separate the duties.
So many of them, and, you know, contention between the herds and so forth.
Right.
Abraham does the noble thing and says, where you want to go.
Sure does. So it was really a strife among the herdsmen, but it could potentially create more problems. And so Abraham says, let's separate and have different spheres, different domains, and gave Lot the best choice. Gave Lot the first choice, whether it's the best choice or not. Gave Lot the first choice. I think we could say it's probably not the best choice. But gave Lot the first choice. And we'll come back to something there in chapter 13, verse 13, in a moment that says something about Sodom, where Lot pitched his tent. But I want you to look at the end of chapter 13. We made the point at the end of class last week that unlike the behavior in Egypt, granting Lot the first choice showed that Abram was going to trust God to provide. When you want to control something, I think I need to sit down and listen to myself. I think I need this lesson really badly, but I think we all do. When you want to control something and you want to control the process and the outcome, then that means, I mean, think about it, you're trying to control, you're in charge. When you trust God, there might be some choices you've got to make, but when you trust God for the outcome. And God has assured Abram that he's going to be well provided for, and so I think this is reflective of Abraham's trust in God. And that's what Abraham's going to do. He's going to struggle with that, and no wonder. And so I want you to look at, and I think this is timely here and reinforces that point that, Abram, you do the right thing and trust me because I promise to take care of you. And so look at this promise again to take care of him. Ray Conies, can you read 13, 14 to 18? This follows on the hill of that. I'll get you in a moment. Daryl, you have it? 13, 14 to 18. I'll come back to you, Ray.
And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord.
Thank you. We run into these incidents here. We encounter these incidents in Genesis, and it's easy to see them as, you know, siloed, just individual events. There's a lot of interconnectivity, and it says there in verse 14, after Lot had separated from him, Abram says to his nephew, you pick the choicest land. After that, what's the promise God makes to Abram? All this land you see, all of it, I'm going to give it to all your descendants. I'm going to give it to your descendants. His descendants, not Lot's, but your descendants. This is still important today with some people, but it was really important in ancient times. And I think it has to do with the fact that there were not social support systems, probably, because things like welfare, social security, insurance policies, etc., of different stripes. And so the idea of amassing and then passing it down in your lineage was of high priority. But of course, there's a lot involved in these promises to Abram. There's more than just that. And so right after Abram concedes Lot the best land, God says, I'm going to give your descendants all this. So just trust me. And Abraham does. Matter of fact, how does Abram respond to this promise at the end of verse 16? 18, I'm sorry. At the end of verse 18. Build an altar to the Lord. You see these expressions of worship on Abram's part toward God. When God does something for him or leads him to a certain thing or promises him something, you see Abram responding with an act of worship. And so it's showing a reciprocal relationship. Because think about it. Genesis starts off so wonderfully, but soon there is a separation between God and man. And now we're starting to see people building a relationship with God, a relationship that had been torn down by earlier events. So that's noteworthy. Okay, let's look at chapter 14 now and what happens next. And again, this is all interconnected. It's important for us to see that. What we have recorded for us in verses 1 to 12 is the invasion of the kings of the east. We're not going to go through reading all that. I know many of you would love to read that out loud, but we're not going to do that, okay? But what we've got in verses 1 to 12 is a summary of an invasion of the Canaan land. So this is what we've got here. And mostly these kings and even some of the places that are mentioned, their city-states that are mentioned, it's hard for us to know exactly where these places are at. Listen, there are places that are referenced in somebody's diary just 150 years ago, let's say in North Carolina, and to this day, well, where was that? Names change, and communities change, and sometimes there's a collection of people living in a community, and eventually they all move out or something. And so the fact that you don't know exactly where a place is located, that's not a strange phenomenon when you study the past. And we're talking here thousands of years ago. So of course that's going to happen. So, but there are some signifiers. Shinar is one of them. Shinar is this area right in here, most likely synonymous with Babel, because in Genesis 11, when the people come and they build that tower, they come to the plain of Shinar. And so here a few chapters later that is mentioned. So that's the same location, that southern Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. And so what we have here is there's a collection of kings and their armies that come up the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley and they invade here. So let's switch over here to this map. The blue line shows them coming here. This is that eastern plateau we've talked about on Wednesday nights. The two main thoroughfares in traveling between Tigris-Euphrates River Valley and Nile River Valley is to come down this plateau here and then cross south of the Dead Sea and head toward Egypt, or to cut through northern Canaan, come through the Jezreel Valley or the Plain of Megiddo, hit this coast right here and come down the coastal plain and go into Egypt. These kings come down through here. And again, some of these places that are listed, it's hard for us to know exactly who they are, but there's enough evidence to tell us that they're coming down this way. They also engage the Amalekites and Amorites south of Canaan. They were concentrated here. They defeat them. And as they turn back this way, these kings here come out and engage them. Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar and so forth. Now, look in verse 4. According to verse 4, why had they invaded? They rebelled. You see here a pattern that follows all the way through the New Testament, and in some ways even beyond. And that is, you've got the mighty peoples, city-states, eventually empires of the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley, right in here. You've got the mighty empire of Egypt here. And in between, you've got smaller states, city-states, or, you know, countries. And those end up being in the vice between Tigris and Euphrates River Valley and Egypt. You see that all the way through, you know, the end of the Old Testament. And a lot of events in the intertestamental period between Old and New Testaments, that's happening too. And so these were almost always smaller and weaker peoples being pulled and tugged by some mighty power either over here or down in Egypt. And they are like what is called traditionally a vassal state. A vassal state is an independent people, but there's some mighty power that basically is ruling over them either heavily or lightly. But for sure, that vassal state has to do what on a regular basis? Pay tribute, pay up, pay taxes. And oftentimes they're actually placing kings on thrones for them, or weighing in on who should be king next, or even prohibiting them from doing this, or making them sell them that material or whatever. So these city-states had been controlled by mighty city-states here, and they come because they have rebelled against them to teach them a lesson. Get back in line. That's why they invade. Okay? And it's a very successful campaign. If you look down to verse 10 to 12, you see that in particular Sodom and Gomorrah come out to fight them. Oh, by the way, who's living in this area? Lot. Sodom and Gomorrah, as well as Zoar, which is Bela, come out and they fight them and they're defeated. And this coalition of Tigris-Euphrates River Valley kings, lower Mesopotamian kings, they mop up with them and they see spoils. And this is common in ancient times. Spoils did not only include gold, silver, animals, cloth, pottery, maybe even. It would sometimes include what? People. If they're rulers in that area, they take them as trophies. And they take them to, you know, send a message and different things like that. See, this is the same thing that played out with Assyria and Babylon in the Old Testament, doing that to Israel and Judah. But in many cases, they're taking people to turn them into slaves. So again, slavery, we've talked about this. Slavery in the ancient world was not really based on race. It was based on economics and military action, 99 times out of 100. And so a very successful campaign. And who is called up in the seizure of spoils? Lot. Now, last we heard about Lot, what kind of status did he have? Pretty good. He had a lot of flocks and herds. So this was some big operation for them to seize what they seized here. Okay? All right, any questions on that invasion? Except how to pronounce some of those names. We'll skip that. Okay, so let's look at what happens here regarding when Abram hears that. Ray Conies, can you read chapter 14, 13 to 16 for us, please?
Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people.
All right, thank you very much. So, let's go back here. What was Abram's response? Just summarize it in a nutshell.
To rescue his Lot.
He rescued Lot, but in the process, what else does he do? As is depicted here. Yeah, he attacks this force and he gets spoils back and gets his nephew back, all those kinds of things. Let's go back here to the map. It says that he overtook them. Now, this is where basically where Abram was, right in here. And he follows them. There is some indication that when this force returned, they came up on the west side of the Jordan River Valley. That's why this is here. I'm not sure all the reasons why this map maker did this, but I looked at this. This is a really good map. And so Abram follows them and engages them here at Dan. Now, Dan is not Dan yet, really. What happens is sometimes in studying the Bible, you refer to a place that's going to be named later. Okay, Bethel's another example of that. But he encounters them at Dan, even pursues them all the way north of Damascus. And Damascus is one of those stakes in the ground. We talked about how that when a place is named, what is this place? We don't know who this place is, but there are occasionally these places listed like Sodom and Gomorrah that we know about where they're at. Damascus is one of those stakes in the ground. Damascus is always Damascus. And so it is in the New Testament. Remember, Saul was traveling to Damascus when he has the vision of the Lord on the road. So Abram defeats them there and regains the spoils. So, victory and recovery. Now, I don't know if you have this question. I have this question. And that is, Abram, he's not Napoleon. He doesn't have a stash of chariot forces like, 8,000 strong or something that we know of. He's a nomadic sheep herder. These invaders seem to have a significant attack force. Look at all the places all the people they defeat, okay? How did Abram do this? Okay?
God.
All right, that does help. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a second. Okay, went right to the answer. Thank you. Well, there's always this combination of natural phenomenon as well as the blessing of God. Because after all, we're told, why is this doing that? Do you know? Why is that jumping? I'm not jumping it. Do you know why it's jumping? Got it. Okay. All right. So the end of verse 13, we find out that Abram has allies. Who are they? The Amorites. And the Amorites, one of the groups that this invading force from Mesopotamia had defeated, but it doesn't mean they've wiped them all out. So he's got some allies. There's that. It lists here, it mentions, it highlights, it focuses, the text does, on Abram using 318 of his own, quote, trained men. Almost every English translation says trained men. Now, this is not the run-of-the-mill servants. Now, I think what you're looking at, too, and we'll mention this in a moment, that, yeah, Abram is just this nomadic herdsman, but he's got quite the household. He's got quite a lot of riches, and he's become what we would say a tribal chief. And you may be thinking, American Indians, you're not far off from that. That's been a phenomenon all the way back to ancient times where you have a loosely connected group of people in a community. Sometimes it's based on a certain family, but somebody emerges as the leader and is usually the person that has proven himself and accomplished a lot or acquired a lot, and he just is given deference, and sometimes he can be the leader of thousands of people in an area without a really tight government system. That's happened all through time. And that's what you see right here, okay? Genesis is just a marvelous piece of history. I'm just telling you that. It's from a personal standpoint. I think Genesis is a marvelous piece of history, as well as the other part of the Bible. But we're in Genesis now, aren't we? He's got 317 trained men. This sounds like a group of what? In our vernacular.
Militia.
Like a militia? Yeah, that's a great term. That's a great term because they've got training, but that may not be their full-time job. Very good. And they appear to be somewhat of an elite force, don't they? And we're told in the text that Abram sneaks up on them at night and splits his forces, which is a risky thing to do, to split your forces when you're outnumbered. Matter of fact, it's insanity to split your numbers when you're outnumbered. But there's a few times in military history where that has paid off. Okay? Okay. And maybe that has something to do with it. But we can also, when we compare this to other events in the Old Testament, like Gideon's raid, etc., and I think Dave's point is well taken, you can't eliminate God's providence here and God's blessings and God's help here. It's not like Abram just goes up there by himself on a camel and waves a stick at him and they all surrender. Now, that would be very miraculous. It's like a Jericho thing. He's actually taking a force and attacking. But they are incredibly successful. And he's able to recover spoils, including Lot. So think about this. I've already mentioned something about Abram morphing into this tribal chief, tribal leader. But now, after this action, how would he be seen? Even more powerful. Even greater respect toward him. Because he's the rescuer. Nobody else could stop these people. And of course, like always through the Old Testament, these characters, and already we've seen this, and that we see this even later on with Isaac and Jacob and so forth, God is with him. His successes are intended to communicate to people that God is with this man. And so he defeats this. And here's another factor. They've already spent themselves. They're on the way home when he attacks them. That's a great time to attack them because they least expect it. And they spent their energy and they're lugging all this spoil. There's all kinds of reasons why that was a really good time. I have a hard time seeing how 318 men can whip this force based on how this force is depicted. Forces of four different kings from Mesopotamia. But I think when you compile, put all this together, that's what you've got. And it shows, it confirms to us as readers, God is with him. And so that brings us, and by the way, to just reinforce this, in verse 13, this is a very personal account of Abram until you get to this chapter. And when you get to the beginning of this chapter, this is... This just reads like some historical account from that time period. And then it includes Abram, and when there's a historical account, people are being identified, just like Mamre was identified. He's identified as what in verse 13? In verse 13, Abram the Hebrew. As readers, we already know this, but in this narrative, he's Abram the Hebrew. He has a descriptive name now. And we could even say Abram of the Hebrews, although he really doesn't have a large family yet. He's got a small family. He's got Lot, wife. He's got a household. That's it. So he's identified as a distinct clan, okay, or ethnic class. This is really like an ethnic distinction, we would say. I want you to go back to this chart that we brought up there a couple weeks ago, and that is, where do you see God fulfilling the initial promises in this incident?
He's making his name great.
That's right, he's making his name great. He sure is. There's different ways I think that happened. Remember I said, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, we brought this up last week. I said, I'm not sure all the ways that God fulfills these things. I think there are a lot of ways that God fulfills these promises. So yeah, he's becoming great in his reputation, isn't he? What else? These people had attacked his family. You don't want to be Abram's enemy.
God gave Abraham what he needed.
Yeah, yeah, he's providing for Abraham, right? He's providing for him. And so you see this kind of protective relationship and relationship of being blessed by God played out here in this incident, as well as other incidents. All right. Anything else on the war with the kings?
Clearly specify how many men Abram brought to the war, but it doesn't say anything about how many men were with Mamre and Eshcol and Aner. Right. And it does seem to make a distinction between them and Abram's.
Yeah.
The Ammonites. Not that it seems to make much difference in
right.
size compared to the
Right. Right. Yeah. Based on all that we know from this time period, and it's scant really in ancient history, this far back. You don't go from the Tigris Euphrates River Valley with a coalition of four city-state kings. You don't invade with 500 men. You don't. You're going to have more than that. So, and all the places that they attack and win, nah, you're going to have more than that. But I think the Amorite allies, probably a factor here in this.
So they were born in his house?
Well, the 318 are born in his house. Yeah. Yeah, he was talking about somebody else. But the 318 are his trained men. So think about it. These are his trained men, and they're 318. He's got even more servants than this. When you count the females and the young ones and the older ones and the ones not trained, and household is his collection of his people, his clan. And so that's a significant number. Yeah, Andrew.
But even if his two allies that are mentioned bring in a comparable number, you're still talking a force of less than 1,000 men.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's outnumbered, way outnumbered, because of this camp. This was a campaign. This was a long, successful campaign. This is not a small force that invaded. No. I think it's a noteworthy victory. That's why it's in the biblical text. Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at what happens next here. After this victory here, and Zachary, can you read verse 17 to 20 first of all, and then I'm going to have you read the rest of it. 17 to 20 first, as Abram comes home.
After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand."
Back here, map again, and Salem is mentioned. Salem, from all evidence, is most likely Jerusalem. That's indicated here in the hill country of, later on, hill country of Judea. And Melchizedek is the king of Salem. Now, at what point does he come out and meet Abram? Is it over here or is it down here? I think it's incidental. But Abram, it says here, it's very clear, it lumps them together. There are two kings that come out, the one from Sodom and the one from Salem. So let's talk about the one from Salem first, okay? He's identified as king of Salem, which is early Jerusalem. And he's also who or what? Priest of God. This is very clear that there were believers in God and people who knew God outside of Abram's family. And we see this later on with Moses in the book of Exodus, when Moses flees Egypt and he goes to Midian and encounters a man named Jethro, who was also what? A priest of God in Midian. So here we have two people, one in Genesis, one in Exodus, outside the circle of Abram's family and his descendants who knew God. So there were others who understood God and worshiped God, and this man was a priest of God. So Melchizedek comes and blesses Abram after his victory. Now, what's the New Testament perspective on this character who just sort of comes in and then leaves? That's all we know about him. And he's not mentioned again, except there's a reference to him in the Psalms. But in the New Testament, what's the importance of Melchizedek? He was a priest, but we know he's a man, right? So he was born and he died, but we have a record of his birth and death. We have a record of his parents. He's just this vague character that comes in and goes out. So in that sense, we don't have an understanding of his beginning and ending. But he's a prototype. He's a forerunner of whom? Jesus Christ. The book of Hebrews makes the point that Jesus is a high priest, but he's not a high priest after the Levitical order, like Aaron and his sons, because they descended from Levi, and at this point, Levi doesn't exist. We're a long way from Levi even being born. This is Levi's great-grandfather, Abram. Levi, Jacob, Isaac, Abraham. And the book of Hebrews is saying Jesus is the high priest forever, truly forever. He's an eternal king and eternal high priest. And he's not after the Levitical priesthood. And that represents how that when Christ came, there was a change. He's a priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Because after all, Jesus would offer access to God to whom? Just to the Jews? Everybody. So how appropriate that a, shall we say, Gentile priest would be the prototype of Jesus Christ. It's not a priest about bloodline. We don't know anything about Melchizedek's bloodline. That's the point of the book of Hebrews. So here's this character's drop right there, blessing Abram. And Abram gave him a tenth of the spoils that he had. And then, Zachary, now read verse 21 to 24, please. The other king.
And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted my hand to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share."
All right, thank you. What did the king of Sodom offer Abram after this victory?
Reward,
payment out of the spoils. What's Abram's response? Nope. And he gives a reason why. He references God, and then he says, "I don't want people saying that you've enriched me." Okay? You take this for what it's worth. I mean, I think this is just what I a little tidbit that I get out of this of wisdom. You need wisdom should dictate that we understand some things when we receive gifts. When you receive a gift and from whom you receive it. With some people, when you receive a gift, there are strings attached. With others, when you receive a gift, you're giving them ammunition. And you may be thinking, you're just old and cranky and jaded. But I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. We want relationships where we can freely give one another gifts and enjoy that grace. Okay, and I'm looking at people that I know that we can share that relationship. But I think that you got to watch who you receive gifts from. Because there can be strings attached, or you can be providing them with ammunition. So he's not going to receive any gifts from Sodom. The exception is some provisions for my men that went with me for their pay, for this time and energy and risk they took and everything like that. So these two were placed right beside each other. That's not by accident. Oh, he just bumped into Melchizedek and bumped into the king of Sodom, and that's just thrown in there by... No. Look what happens. Think about this. Compare this king to Melchizedek. Go back and look at chapter 13, verse 13. What was Sodom like? Exceedingly wicked. He's the king of the exceedingly wicked ones. That's all we know about him. Okay? But that's enough. So, look at the contrast. From Melchizedek, Abram received what? A blessing. And that blessing was from whom? God. He blessed him in the name of God. There's fulfillment of the promise, right? I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless those who bless you. So he blesses Abram in the name of God, and Abram receives that from Melchizedek, this godly man. But from the man who's the king of the wicked, what? He doesn't take anything. Not even a sandal strap. That's like us saying not even a shoestring. I mean, a shoestring. Talking about shoestring budgets, right? Not even a shoestring will he take it. And here's Abram. Of course, Lot is what's motivated him. But here he does this great service to these people here in the southern Dead Sea area. Abram is wise. He's not going to connect himself to these people. He's not going to get tied to these people. He's keeping a reasonable distance. Yeah, Andrew?
This feels like a lesser version of what we saw very early in Genesis. We have a contrast between two people. Early on, it was Cain and Abel. Here we have the king of Salem and the king of Sodom, and you can't have a much bigger contrast than that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they're thrown next to each other for that contrast point, weren't they? No. Okay. Wonderful. 15. Can't get to all this. That's okay. We'll get to what we can. In chapter 15, 1 to 6. Vince, can you read those verses?
After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." And Abram said, "O Lord God, what wilt thou give me, since I am childless, and heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus?" And Abram said, "Since thou hast given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir." Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir." And he took him outside and said, "Look, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he said, to him, "So shall your descendants be." How far?
One more.
Okay. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness.
All right, thank you.
Note how in this saga about Abram that God reinforces the promise. His descendant, his nation after him, receiving the land, all of this. Think about it. When you reiterate something, repeat something, why?
Make assurance.
Yeah, to assure someone. What else? Why do you keep reiterating something? Importance of it. Right. Sometimes we talk about the idea of soaking in. What do we mean by, "I want this to soak in"? What do we mean by that? Accept it, believe it, take hold of it. And something you have to get saturated with, because it's not something you're going to grab like that. It's got to soak in. These are incredible things that God is promising Abram. And Abram, for the most part, will not see them fulfilled. They will be fulfilled after he's dead. Not all of it, but some of it. And so God continues to reinforce these things. And in this incident, Abram comes to God with a question. What's the question? "I have no children. How can these things be?" Is that a reasonable question?
Sure.
Absolutely it is. He's already got an heir picked out. Who is it? Yeah, it's one of his servants. That shows you how fluid servanthood was in ancient times. Most people born and died a servant, but it can be pretty fluid. He inherited all this. But God does two things here. First of all, he clearly identifies what about the heir? It's not going to be a servant. It's going to be your son. Abraham, who's aged, and Sarah, who's aged, it's going to be a child from you, okay? Then he illustrates the surety of that promise that he'd have a son that would multiply into a large nation. How does he illustrate it for Abram? Go and look at the stars. That's going to be your offspring. Now, this is accommodative kind of language, but when you saw the Israelites coming out of Egypt and you looked at them, it wouldn't be far-fetched in a, you know, kind of figurative language to say, wow, there's as many as the stars of the heavens. It's that kind of idea. What do you make of verse 6? Very important. He believed him. He believed God. His faith is what made him right with God. Righteousness with God. That means right with God. And it was his faith in those promises that led him to obey God by doing all the things that God called him to do, beginning with migrating from lower Mesopotamia to Haran to Canaan. Now, why is this principle right here? He believed the Lord and is committed to him or accounted to him as righteousness. Why is that principle important to us? Of course it does. It's repeated in the New Testament. When Paul is trying to make the point about the gospel, how we're justified by faith in Christ, he references this. This is how you're made right with God. It's not the law. It's faith. Faith that led Abram to do all that he did in submission to God, but it's faith. And I want you to think about this. The key to Abram's faith, the key thing he had to believe in, is listed right here. Abram, though he was old, had to believe that what? He's going to have a son. Abram had to believe in the son that God would provide. How are we saved? By believing in the son that God would provide. Jesus the Christ. That's how we're justified before God. All right. Questions, comments?
How can anybody with an honest heart read through this and not see it? I mean, there's just too many of those shadows and types and parallels. It's just faith building.
If you accept it as a legitimate record, there's no wiggle room. So you have to reject it as not a true record.
I don't even see how people can do that.
But then when you really, and I do think that most people who think that have never read it. When you really read it, and then really read it, and really study it, it's hard to dismiss it. Just it's nothing to this. Somebody just made this up. This is such, as I said earlier, it's substantial. It's a substantial record. With people being named and places being named and it fitting the culture and fitting the way of life and the economics and the travel patterns and everything else. It's a brilliant piece of history. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll try to get to the end of 15 and then get into the next couple chapters next time. Thank you.